Good afternoon. This is Alicia Bales. I have live in the studio with me Dr. Drew Colfax. Good afternoon. Thanks for coming back in.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Great to see you again. And we have on the phone Dr. Suzanne Hiramatsu, the Director of Emergency Medicine at Pacific Redwood Medical Group, which manages the emergency department at the Ukiah Hospital. This is our daily update on local coronavirus response. I just have one update for you, just one announcement before we get started. There was a press conference scheduled for 4 o'clock today by the County of Mendocino, and that has been canceled. They're still going to do a video press conference, but I guess to ensure the safety of the employees and the press, they're not gathering people together today. So they're going to put out a video of the press conference, but we don't know exactly when. The best estimate they could give me was between 4 and 5. We were planning on playing that press conference live at 4, so we will be playing Democracy Now! As scheduled. And I'm not sure exactly when we will be airing the audio of the press conference, but you can certainly watch it at YouTube at the Mendocino County YouTube page at Mendocino County Video. It's youtube.com/MendocinoCountyVideo, or at the county's Facebook page, which is facebook.com/MendocinoCounty. So with that, let's go ahead and start with our daily update. And we're going to give you time to call in. If you don't have the call-in number already, it's 895-2448. We'll give you the chance to call in probably in about 10 minutes or so.
Sure.
We'll take it away.
Suzanne, you there?
Hi.
Hi, thanks for calling in. I know you're really busy. Let me just first run a couple of the local numbers. So far, the county has sent 156 tests. 117 of those have come back negative. 37 are still pending. And the total positive count remains unchanged at 2. A caller yesterday expressed concern about the location of these individuals with the positive tests, and I explained the rationale being that we really want to keep this undisclosed, to keep it as a county-wide problem rather than as a localized issue. I think what I did not address was her concern that this new individual, or either of these individuals, could have been transmitting it to other people when they're out and about in the community. Both of these people, as far as we can tell, did not acquire COVID through what we call local transmission. They acquired it by coming into contact with others who had known disease from the Bay Area or from elsewhere. So we still have not yet picked up any local transmission cases. Both of these individuals were flagged as high-risk individuals and were quarantined immediately after they're coming into contact with the COVID positive, with the other COVID positive individual. So with that said, and to briefly summarize sort of the national outlook on this, New York continues to be really quite grim. The national case count's increasing at about a rate of 14,000 a day. This is positive tests. We're about 70,000 national positive tests, with nearly 1,000 deaths already just in the United States. I should say that the test count is really, it's a poor marker of how many cases there are. We're still not getting nearly as many tests as we need. The better marker of sort of where things stand is how many people are being hospitalized, and the crush on the New York hospitals is pretty grim. They're still managing, but the curve is sharper than they expect to be able to manage over the next several days. The trend is also extremely worrisome for the South. Many people fear that New Orleans might be facing a Katrina type of event over the next couple of weeks. Florida and other regions in the South are a little bit slower in the social distancing and the shelter-in-place policies that we've enacted here and that they enacted on the East Coast. So we could see a huge outbreak in cases, depending on testing rate over the next week or two. Suzanne, I know you've been working probably 100 hours a week for the last month getting ready over there. Can you talk a little bit about where things stand in terms of preparedness for the pandemic when and if it hits this county, and what your concerns are and what you want our listeners to be cognizant of?
Yeah, thank you for having me on. We have been madly preparing, and unfortunately having, you know, been able to watch Washington, Santa Clara County, New York go through this. before us, that has given us an opportunity to look at our own infrastructure, sort of plan ahead and make contingency plans, because we do expect that, you know, obviously the shelter in place will help, but we are expecting a probable surge in California as well. We're hoping the surge is not as quite as severe, but that's what we always have to plan for, the worst in emergency medicine. So Adventist has been very proactive. We've been able to look at our ED flow as well as set up an outside tent to allow for evaluation of patients that may be presenting with URI, or what we call upper respiratory illness symptoms, or flu-like symptoms. There's what we ideally would like to do is to be able to prevent any patient from infecting anyone else when they come to the ER, as well as prevent any transmission to our healthcare providers. So in an effort to do that, we have different levels of contingency plans. Right now, we want to thank the community because there does seem to be a little bit of a lull or drop in emergency department use, which is definitely helping us because we're able to better cohort patients. So when we're experiencing numbers like we are right now, it's fairly easy to keep patients away from other patients. When any patient comes to the ER, they're asked immediately if they're presenting for any symptoms such as a fever, cough, or shortness of breath, if they have any risk factors that might have exposed them to coronavirus, for example, travel, have they interacted with someone that has coronavirus, and other maybe questions sort of related to what their underlying medical problems are. If people are following this disease on the news, they know that individuals over the age of 60 to 65 or those that have what we call comorbidities or other illnesses or chronic illnesses such as diabetes, COPD, heart problems, maybe at a higher risk to have some complications secondary to coronavirus. So those things are assessed immediately as soon as you get to the ER. We then take vitals and then direct patients to the appropriate area. We have a way to evaluate patients in an outside tent if needed. We also have a way to evaluate patients in private rooms. And whenever patients come in with these symptoms, a mask is placed over them. I know that there's a lot of concern as to, you know, how contagious are these patients? Are we at risk if we're in the same room with them? What if they're wearing a mask? And now that we're able to finally get some of the information from China and from some of the European countries, it's looking like if the patient has a surgical mask or something that's sort of covering their cough so that they don't create what we call droplets, it does seem to be fairly protective. So any patient presenting with those symptoms will have a mask given to them, and they will be expected to wear that during their visit. And then our staff we are very fortunate that we do have PPE, or what we call personal protective equipment, at this time to help us evaluate these patients in a safe manner. The hospital has been working very hard on worst-case scenarios, so not just evaluating these patients in the ER and what would happen if we saw more patients, or what would happen if more patients came to the ED than beds. We have been working very hard on contingency plans. Adventists can speak more to this, but there are lots and lots of layers of surge planning that is already being thought out. And I think it's safe to say that we can't say 100% that we are ready to go, but we know and are planning for the worst and have been very fortunate to be able to reach out for more ventilators, reach out for more staff. The community has been amazing and willing to offer donations for masks. So we feel very supported in that way. As far as testing, I think that that's the question that seems to be on a lot of our patients' minds. A lot of people may be at home wondering, you know, I have a sore throat, or I don't really feel that well. Maybe I have a cough or a runny nose. How do I know if I have coronavirus? And unfortunately, right now in California, we are still in this situation where testing is, we don't have a widespread testing availability. In the next few days, maybe next few weeks, as the FDA tests become available to us, we might be able to provide more testing to people. But right now, what we're really cautioning patients is to think carefully about your symptoms. If you do not feel like you're having moderate to severe symptoms, it's probably best actually to presume or pretend like you do have coronavirus. Stay home. Don't interact with other people. As long as you can control your symptoms at home, you know, stay hydrated, take Tylenol as needed for a fever. Really try to avoid getting anyone else sick, washing your hands a lot. And really only using the hospital for evaluation if you feel like you're really getting worse, you're not able to control your symptoms at home. Because unfortunately, while we do have tests for patients that may need to come into the hospital where it's a critical decision, or, you know, is this a healthcare provider that, you know, may be spreading this to other people, we have those tests, but we don't have tests like we did for influenza where everyone could just come in and get an influenza test. And to be honest, despite what people may be seeing on social media or on the general news, there is not a great therapy that has been identified at this time. There has been rumor about chloroquine or azithromycin. These are medications that I think people may have heard President Trump talking about. But the fact is that a lot of these medications aren't actually available to us because they just weren't used that frequently or there's a shortage at this time. And we're seeing more studies come out kind of showing that maybe there is not actual clinical benefit. So will a test actually help us? Generally not. And in fact, a lot of times we may not be getting these tests back in a timely manner. So clinicians are actually, or your physicians are actually making decisions to support sick patients without the information. And so performing a test, if there is no therapy available, really doesn't actually help us. So I would encourage people not to come to the hospital for testing, but to stay home if you can and try to self-isolate. In the near future, we really do hope to be able to have that sort of testing available, but it's not something that we have right now.
And you've covered a lot of points that I think we've been making on the show over the course of the past week. I know that you and I and every other provider and probably every listener would love to have a widely available, highly accurate test that came back quickly. And unfortunately, we don't have a test that meets any of those criteria. The few tests that we do have are taking, you know, days to weeks to come back, and it's not really clear how accurate they are. And so it's a problem on a local and a national level. But one point I've been making, and you just made it, is the test on an individual basis is actually really not going to change our clinical management. It's very important for sort of healthcare, you know, management in general and public health to get tests out there to get an idea of prevalence in the population. But on the individual level, what I'm hearing you say, Suzanne, is it's really not going to change management. It really is a question of how do you feel? Do you feel so poorly that you need to come to the hospital and be evaluated rather than I feel a little sick and this might be the flu or is this coronavirus?
Correct. So, you know, the test really doesn't help us when a patient comes to the ER or when they're even admitted to the hospital because it's not that the coronavirus is creating a problem that we can fix easily. It's that when a patient comes in and they're actually very sick, we're just going to help their lungs function. We're going to support their heart function, and we're going to treat them medically like we would for any other viral syndrome. So whether or not this patient has coronavirus, you know, informs our decision whether or not we need to wear specific protective personal gear when we're managing that patient. It informs our decision where that patient should be and how isolated they should be, but it really doesn't help us decide that much, you know, what we're going to do for these patients, because really, it's, unfortunately, supportive care for all of these patients. There's not an antibiotic we can give at this time. There's not a therapeutic option that would, you know, be borne out by a test.
Right. It's really just a question of, you know, ventilatory support, fluids, breathing treatments, maybe antibiotics if we're worried about a secondary bacterial infection, but aggressive early treatment of this does not seem to change the clinical course.
Right,
and much like, sorry, but it's also very much like the influenza test. I mean, really, you know, ER doctors don't like sending influenza tests because it really doesn't change it. We can look at somebody and say, you have the flu, go home and rest and drink plenty of fluids and take ibuprofen and Tylenol. This can be managed in the same way without the test.
All right, let me reintroduce you guys. That was Dr. Drew Colfax, ER physician at Ukiah Adventist Hospital. And on the line is Dr. Suzanne Hiramatsu. She's the director of emergency medicine at Pacific Redwood Medical Group. We are going to open the phone line, see what's on people's minds today, and see what kind of questions are percolating out there. And we do have our first call, but let me remind you, the number here is 895-2448. That's 707-895-2448. Good afternoon, caller. You're live on the air. Go ahead and turn your radio off.
Yeah,
we can hear it in the background.
Sorry. It's Dr. Dave again from the coast. Does anybody know any more up-to-date information about whether ACE inhibitors or ARBs are either beneficial or not? Don't do anything or maybe have a negative effect? And if it's negative or not, separate from the underlying conditions that people take those for? Again, I'll take my answer off the air.
All right.
Thank you for taking my call.
You want to translate that for us?
So he's asking about a couple classes of anti-high blood pressure medications, and there's some plausible biologic mechanism where they could make an individual more susceptible to get the illness or get more ill from the illness. The current recommendation out of the CDC is that nobody should stop taking any of their chronically prescribed medications in the light of this pandemic, nor is there any indication to start taking any medication to help prevent the infection.
Correct. I agree with that. The mechanism of that is thought that if you take an ACE inhibitor for blood pressure, it may increase the susceptibility or the ability for the virus to bind. But then there's actually concern that that may actually be the opposite. So no one's really come out with any good data that I've been able to see looking at Chinese data or the French data so far that would suggest one way or the other. And definitely agree with following the CDC guidelines on that.
And I think Dr. Dave actually called yesterday and asked about testing, so what sort of tests were in the pipeline. And I actually did a little research on that this morning early. And there are some tests out there that are going to hopefully test for antibodies, which will then be able to tell us if somebody has been infected and developed immunity to this coronavirus. Those are not yet commercially available. There's some talk that they could become available very soon, but roll out on a national scale, of course, is going to be a bit of a barrier to that.
All right, we have another call. Good afternoon, caller. You're live on the air.
Oh, hello. Good afternoon. My question concerns the long-term effects of this pandemic, and please correct me if my information is incorrect. I understand this is a non-human virus, so humans don't have any antibodies for anything like this, which is maybe why it's so contagious and so people are getting so sick. So in that it's not a human virus, can we, if we get sick, do we develop immunity to it? And then what happens to that immunity if the virus mutates and there's a second wave or a third wave? Will the immunity from the first wave change, or will it be, you know, immaterial? And I will hang up and take your answer. Thank you.
Excellent question. Suzanne, you want to field that? I've been talking a lot in the last week.
Yeah. So I was actually fortunate enough to be on a recent discussion with some critical care and infectious disease doctors that were talking about just that. A couple of things about coronavirus. It is one of a family of viruses that can infect animals. And as you know, there are about four that have been able to mutate in a way that they also be able to infect humans. A lot of these actually do pass around in children, and we call them seasonal coronaviruses, which is some of the reason why some researchers in China have been thinking maybe this is somewhat the protection that we're seeing in little kids. Little kids seem to be, on average, handling this better because they may have some immune response that is similar enough and able to fight off this new SARS-CoV-2 because they do have some immunity. Thus far, there is not enough research to say whether or not the immunity that people seem to get, or the we have been able to see that they do form antibodies, so they should have some sort of an immunity. We don't know how long that duration is, and that varies between different viruses, which is why you have to get a tetanus shot every 10 years, but a different shot maybe, I can't even think of an example off the top of my head, but more frequently. We just don't have the information because this one is so new. We can't say how long that immunity will last. I will say that there has been some research to show that the virus thus far does not appear to be mutating throughout the American population. There was a virulent, or what we call more aggressive, form that was centered in Wuhan, and then a second form that seems to be the more stable one, that is the one that's passing around. And as of yesterday, it appeared that it was not changing any significant portions where we would see a significant change in whether or not it was aggressive. But, you know, viruses change, and so we can't say definitively, but the thought is that this one right now has been quite stable for a while.
Yeah, although that's still evolving quite a bit, and there's question whether the New York experience over the course of the past week, when compared to, say, the Northern California experience, has been so different, right? Because California and New York both presumably got this virus fairly early on, and whether that has to do with some sort of small mutations or not, we just there's a lot of data that's being collected and a lot of people that are looking at it, but we just don't have the definitive answers at this point.
All right, let's take another call. Nope, lost him. Okay, the number is 895-2448. The lines are open now, and here they are. Hello, caller. You're live on the air.
Yeah, my question is, if I'm taking painkilling medication, hydrocodone for back pain, is that going to compromise my immune system? And I'll take my answer off the air.
So no, that in of itself is not considered a medication that compromises your immune system. Medications that could compromise one's immune system, and frankly, we don't really know how they're going to interact with the COVID infection, would be medications that people take for chronic inflammatory conditions. So these would be immune modulating medications. The other category are medications that are used to treat cancers, though again, it's not clear how much these medications increase one's risk. What is clear, coming from the data out of China, is high blood pressure, chronic lung disease, chronic kidney disease, heart failure are all, to a varying degree, conditions that increase the risk of developing a more severe form of this illness.
All right, the lines are lighting up, so let's just keep taking some questions. Hey, caller, you're live on the air. Can you turn your radio off, please?
Hi. Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Hi. My name is Liu Fei. I'm Chinese, by the way. My hometown is Wuhan. Is from Hubei province. Hello, can you hear me?
Hi.
Go ahead. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question. So, I just mentioned yesterday. So, if a coronavirus, a lot of American people don't have much chance to get a test.
I was doctor, and I in China, in Wuhan, 1.5 months ago, have a nurse who is Chinese. She got the coronavirus from her work, but when she at home, took 3 weeks, she takes some medicine and some tea, Chinese tea and a lot of different tea, and she writes in the blog, and she tells the people, so she didn't go to the hospital, she stayed at home to fight the virus, and she success. So right now she recovered, so she writes that blog, which is in Chinese, but I hope a lot of people can research and can Google, can find out. And I believe in American because I've been in the U.S. already 5 months now. So in the USA have a lot of good tea and good vegetable, which is can help a lot of people can fight back with medicine. So people shouldn't just waiting for the test. Just take care of themselves
right.
with their kitchen.
Thank you very much for the comment.
Be confident.
All right. Thanks.
No, and I think the caller makes a good point in terms of being able to take care of oneself and to manage one's own symptoms at home. And, you know, things that we all do and take when we are sick, such as tea, fluids, rest. Some people, I prefer grapefruit juice when I feel ill. You know, whatever makes you feel better as you get through for what will be a benign illness in the vast majority of us is certainly advisable. And home treatment is what I have been urging over and over and over again here on the radio show, with the caveat being that when you start to get sick, if you are in that unfortunate minority of people who's going to get really sick from this disease, then you need to seek medical attention.
All right. Should we take another call?
Why don't we take one more?
Yeah, we probably got time for one more. Hello, caller. You're live on the air.
Yes, I'm wondering how long does the virus live outside of the human body, the droplets? Thank you.
Great question. Thanks for that.
Yeah, so, Suzanne, you want to take that? You there?
Yeah, so it depends. There's a couple of things. The virus is detectable on different surfaces for varying times. There's been a few papers that have come out recently. One of those was in a laboratory setting where they looked at duration on plastic, metal, cardboard, and then they aerosolized or they sprayed the virus around. And it looks like anywhere from about 24 hours to maybe 2 to 3 days, you can find particles. Now, there's a difference between being able to find a particle and also determining whether or not that particle is still infectious. And that has yet to be determined. Definitely, even on the Princess cruise, they were able to find particles that survived from 7 to 13 days, but whether or not those particles were actually infectious, we can't really say, and it's not thought to be likely. So I would say, on average, for paper, about 24 hours, plastic, maybe 2 days, metal, sort of around that range. So that underscores the importance of really just washing your hands a lot and cleaning those surfaces that you touch frequently.
Do they know how long it persists on clothing?
I don't believe that there was a cotton or a clothing.
No, it was just plastic, copper, metal, and cardboard. But, you know, a lot of clothing is plastic, perhaps not in this county, but more organic clothing probably would be somewhere around the cardboard type of range, would be my estimate. Yeah, I've heard a lot of questions about how long this stays in the environment. One thing to understand is to contract any disease, you don't just need a single virum or one bacterium to get the disease. You need a certain load of the virus or the bacteria to contract the disease. It's not clear yet how big of a viral load you need to be exposed to contract this disease. But what we do know is that the virus dies in a continuous fashion once it leaves the body. And so while it may live on plastic for 2 to 3 or even 4 or 5 days, the quantity of the virus on that plastic is decreasing significantly every hour. And so by day 3, the amount is going to be a logarithmically smaller amount than it was on day 1. And Suzanne touched on the point, just because we can detect the virus through RNA analysis does not mean that it is present in a quantity or in a form that makes it dangerous any longer.
All right, that's going to do it for the update today. It's 3:30, and I want to thank you both, Dr. Drew Colfax and Dr. Suzanne Hiramatsu. Thank you so much for coming on KZYX today and making yourself available for calls, and I think we'll be back again tomorrow at 3. It seems to be really serving our listeners, and so thanks very much.
Suzanne, thank you. Get back to work.
Thank you. Have a good day.